Well, it's not a surprise to you what the topic is. It's printed on your program. And as Brother Paul prayed, a blessing on Brother Malley's service entitled Jacob's Trouble. Brother Malley.
It's always a privilege for Mary and I to be with the Lord's people in convention. I bring you love and greetings from your brethren in Connecticut, in the New London, Greater New London area. Also, the love and greetings of your brethren in the Fort Myers area. It's a very small class there, but they think of you and they wish they could be here. I've learned so much this week with all of the lessons, the discourses. The fellowship has just been enormous. It's been a mountaintop experience. And I'm grateful for the assigned topic because it gives me a chance to review some of the concepts that we've known for so long and also to update it. We need to be updated from time to time. And we think we have some updating material for you. You know, Jacob's trouble is probably one of the most popular prophecies. Everybody knows about Jacob's trouble. It's highlighted in convention after convention. And I'm going to make some suggestions to you. Let me say right from the very beginning. Jacob's trouble is a special type of trouble. Because Jacob has had a lot of trouble. But this one that we're talking about is a special type of trouble. And therefore, it is still future. So if I begin to describe some other troubles, don't forget, we're still talking about Jacob's trouble in the future. Let me begin with, why are we interested in Jacob's trouble? Why? Well, we think, first of all, Jacob's trouble is an index of other events. When we're in Jacob's trouble, we know the elect class is taken up. It's gone. So if you're still around when Jacob's trouble is starting, you can say to yourself, I've been left out. As we would suggest to you that the church class would have been complete by then. And Armageddon was probably started as well, so that Jacob's trouble, and I know this is a debatable item, it could be in the middle of the Armageddon, could be near the beginning, I put it at the end. But I don't know. I don't know for sure. But we know that Armageddon is going on as well. So it's an index of events. And even after the great company class has been taken up, the resurrection of the ancient worthies, the beginning of the kingdom. So Jacob's trouble is like a milestone. And so we're interested in it. And interested in the signs of the times for it. Now, Jacob's trouble brings reality to the scriptures. And we're always interested in prophecy fulfilled. It enriches our faith and adds to our understanding. And finally, Jacob's trouble is a major ring in God's time clock. If you want to know what God is doing, look to Israel. God is in Israel. God is not in Disneyland. And he's not in Washington. And he's not in Rome. He's in Israel. So as we track and as we trace the events in Israel, we can be tracking and tracing the Lord's handiwork. The term Jacob's trouble comes from Jeremiah 33. And it connects with Ezekiel 38 and 39. It's the final conflict falling on regathered Israel. Now, the emphasis is on regathered Israel. Now, this curve shows a kind of a crescendo, an escalating trouble for Jacob. Now, I said, we're looking for this, the crescendo. But let's not ignore the fact that Israel has had a lot of other troubles as well. If we go back to where it all began, 1878, when 15 Russian Jews settled in Pitativka, we can then say, here is the real beginning of troubles. Not Jacob's trouble, but the real beginning of troubles. And you can see the curve just gradually goes up. And the second point on the curve was in 1896, when Herzl wrote the White Paper. Let me say something about Herzl. Herzl is a very famous hero in Israel. Started the Zionist movement. But do you know, originally, Herzl was a very successful lawyer in Austria, in Vienna. Very successful. He had no interest in starting a homeland for the Jews. He approached the Catholic Church and asked them if they would help him combat anti-Semitism. And he said to the Catholic Church that if you help combat anti-Semitism, I will try to convert every Jew to Catholicism. It's a matter of history. What do you think the Catholic Church said? No, we won't help. And so Herzl then saw that the only answer to the Jewish question was a homeland. And so he wrote the White Paper, which set in motion the Zionist movement. Then in 1916, we have the Balfour Declaration. This is where Britain gave land for the Jews. 1916, a very small little memo, a declaration. You having trouble seeing this? Up, like that? How's that? I've seen the actual copy of the Balfour Declaration. The originally signed one that was an exhibit in Jerusalem. It's about so wide, so high, and you would think it was in a document, a comprehensive document like lawyers usually put together. Just a simple little piece of paper. We grant the Jews the right to settle in Palestine. And so 1916 that occurred. But in 1922, the Arabs reacted. They didn't want it, and the British backed down. And that began the decline of the British Empire. Up to that point, England owned half the world. After that point, England began to decline. I'm reminded of the prophecy, I will bless them that bless thee, and I will curse them that curse thee. Then came 1935. Where the Jews lost their citizenship in Germany. That was a significant event because the Jews were then cast out of the culture at the time, and it emphasized the fact that a homeland for Jews was the only answer. Then in 1945 was the Holocaust. 6 million Jews by Nazi Germany were exterminated. Talk about ethnic cleansing. That was a big one. And then there were several wars. But it was the 1967 war that was significant because the land expanded tenfold. But most significantly, Israel was in charge of Jerusalem. They had Jerusalem. This was the significant thing. And so the curve of troubles begin, and so we're looking forward now as it continues up. Gog begins to emerge, and then finally the battle, what we call the battle of Jacob's trouble. There are four reasons for the trouble. God has said the diaspora of Jews is coming to an end. And so consequently, he wants to regather all the Jews back to Israel or Palestine. And so first purpose is to save those who have regathered. God's not going to bring people from all over the world and put them in all in one spot, so have one atomic bomb and they're all obliterated. And so the first purpose is deliverance. Deliverance of the regathered Jews. The second is to make a full end to anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is the world's worst hate. Hate for the Jews. And history will record it's the greatest hate. It's the longest hate. It's the most lethal hate. And God himself will purge that hate out of the hearts and minds of man. A third purpose is to purge the land for a remnant. And by that we mean in Zephaniah 3:11-13, to purge out the land of the rebels, of the transgressors, of the unclean. And finally, a purpose, a time has come to favor Israel and let the world know that God has favored Israel. We see this in the double of Israel. If we take 1812, which is the beginning of Jacob himself, up to the time of 33 AD, the first advent of Jesus, this was a period of favor, 1845 years. If we flop this over as a double, the Mishnah, we find that period of time, 1845, arrives at 1878. Significant because that was the time when 15 Russian Jews settled in Pitatifka. Now, if we take that same date, 1812, and take it up to the time when the temple was being harassed and about to be destroyed, and we take that period of 1880, a period of favor, and flop it over into a Mishnah double, we find that 1880 results in 1878, which then is the beginning of favor to Israel. The Mideast leaders, we have two of them that are very significant, Barak and Arafat. They have agreed on a plan that will settle the status of Jerusalem. This is not well known. It came out very briefly. But as you know, Jerusalem has been the stumbling block. And so they have agreed. And this is the agreement. They have agreed that both will claim Jerusalem as their capital. But Barak has said, I don't want the capital divided. We want the capital of Israel to remain intact. But we will give you a very small village in the greater Jerusalem metropolitan area, a little village called Abu Dis. See that right there? Oh, it's too small for you to see it. Abu Dis. A little higher. Right there. Abu Dis. It's still in the metropolitan Jerusalem area, but it is in the extreme east of Jerusalem. So Barak says, you can have your capital at this point, and we will have the capital in the rest of the city. Two countries claiming the same capital. This is the agreement they made. Ah, but Arafat says, but we want more. And Barak says, what do you want? We want control of all the religious sites in Jerusalem. We want to control the Temple Mount. We want to control the Christian churches. We want to control the Armenian churches. We want to control the Orthodox churches. What do you think Barak said? Okay, you got him. I don't think the Pope knows about this yet. As you know, the Pope has been interested in making Jerusalem an international city mandated and controlled by the United Nations. So when he hears about it, we're going to get some real reactions. Now, I want to stress this. This is an agreement between Barak and Arafat, but has not been ratified by the Knesset and the parliament of the PLO. We might suggest that might take 500 years to get it ratified. But nonetheless, that is the compromise they made. The Jews want peace. They want peace more than anything else. They want peace more than land. You might ask, why? Why was Netanyahu ousted? And why are the Jews willing to give up land for peace? Let me make some suggestions to you. First, they want terrorism stopped. It's a very stressful thing for a mother with children to go into a mall and wondering if a bomb is going to blow up. It's very stressful. And they want to stop that. And second is, they're tired of war. They've had war since 1948. Six wars with one Scud missile. 22 Arab nations surrounding Israel, aiming missiles and guns and airplanes and bullets. They're weary of war. The third is, they're tired of wandering. They're tired of being oppressed. They're tired of being persecuted. They want a home that's safe and that's peaceful. These are the things that they want. But Israel has some internal problems. These problems are very critical and they're huge. The first problem is, the voters do not want a theocratic state. Netanyahu was moving Israel to a theocratic state. As you know, 10% of the Jews in Israel is ultra-Orthodox. 90% represent the liberals, the conservatives, and the reforms, and also the secular. Netanyahu was moving more and more toward a theoretical state, and the rest of Israel didn't want it. It might be of interest to you to know that 1,000 of these ultra-Orthodox Jews in a recent convention, 1,000 of them, the recent, declared that the liberals, the conservative, the reforms, the secular were not Jews at all. The only Jews were the ultra-Orthodox. I have a friend who is a Reformed Jew, and he's been going back and forth to Israel over this issue, back and forth, and the old question has reemerged. Who is a Jew? Historically, it was the one who was born of a Jewish mother. The ultra-Orthodox won't accept that. And so the issue has... this is a critical problem in Israel. Next is, the Orthodox do not serve in the military. nor do they have to work. The government exempts 30,000 seminary Orthodox students since they will be serving God. This is a drain on the budget. It's a drain on money. And even the rabbis and these seminary students, they get a stipend from the government. The government supports them. And also may be of interest to know that the government is expected to build a synagogue every three quarters of an hour of walk in an area. Because, you see, they cannot walk too far during the Sabbath. And therefore, if it's more than three quarters of an hour walk, they have to build a synagogue. There's another problem that's very critical. And the problem is water. Water is probably more important to Israel than land. And here is where internal strife is emerging. Right now, Israel is living on the edge of life. They're going to run out of water in 10 to 15 years. They need 120 desalinization plants like tomorrow. The immigration of Jews coming in from all over the world is demanding more and more water. Water is more important to them than land. So they need to settle the military conflicts so that they can release the defense budget for purposes of solving internal problems. Rather interesting on the Kosovo. Kosovo was a minority section in the state of Yugoslavia. When Kosovo said to Yugoslavia, "We want our independence," Yugoslavia says, "How are you going to get your independence when you are on Yugoslavia territory? Who are these people in Kosovo?" There were the Albanians that came in from Albania. They are the Macedonians that came in from Macedonia. They are the Greeks that came in from Greece. They came from all over and thus started a minority pocket. Now, the point is, there are 232 nations in the world. Every nation has a minority population. If Kosovo was championed by the United States and the United Nations and NATO, could all of these minority pockets emerge and say, "We want our independence and want the United States to help us in that"? It's a big problem. I just wanted to show you, Quebec has been trying to get independent status for years. They've been doing it peacefully with the vote. And the United States, the Black Panthers, wanted five states to form Black America. The five states they wanted was North and South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. Would the United States allow a minority group to form their own country? If you say yes, that's a radical idea. If you say no, the United States would go to war, that's exactly what Yugoslavia did. Exactly what they did. If we were to establish how many Jews there are in the world, approximately, the figure 14 million is not too far away. This is the number of Jews in the world. And this curve represents the growth of the Jews in Israel. 1878, there were 15. In 1948, at the birth of the nation, there were 600,000. And then you can see the curve keeps going up. At the present level, they are working on the 6 million plan. I think the 7 million plan has already been developed. There's still 2.5 million in Russia, and there's 5.5 million in the United States. It's my view that anybody and everybody who wants to immigrate to Israel, God is going to encourage them. There'll be those who will not want to, and I don't think that's going to stop the program. But those who want to will be given that privilege. The regathering is a miracle. I see it as the second Exodus. We had the first Exodus out of Egypt was a miracle. They had a series of miracles. And so was the second. You can't see these miracles because they saw Moses. Moses was a literal figure, a literal person, and the one leading Israel out of the diaspora cannot be seen. You see. Now, you can't see the figures coming here, but I wanted to just show you where they're coming from, all these different countries. The regathering is stupendous. In 1990, which was the biggest immigration from Russia, there was 185,000 that left Russia. This past year, the immigration will reach 60,000. And they hope to increase that. But the important thing is, it's not just an immigration, but there are those who want to come to Israel. There are those who want to leave Russia. There are those who have recognized that the time for regathering back to the homeland has happened. And we see the land has been a seesaw. The rate of regathering has exceeded the land acquisition rate. You know, there's fundamentally three components to Jacob's trouble. First, returning to the land is the problems of the return, settling and so forth. The second component is displacing those that are in the land and the reaction that they're making. And the third is experiencing the effects of anti-Semitism as they come into the land. In 1920, you could see the mandate, the land of Palestine with Transjordan. 1922, you could see Transjordan was created as a state, and this was Palestine. And then in 1947, which was the preliminary for the United Nations division, 1949, we see more of the structure. 1967, this was the land expansion, which everybody thought was the beginning in which God was going to give all the land promised to Israel. I'm sure many of you have thought of that. After 1967, six-day war? 6 days? A tenfold increase? I was excited. The Lord is finally giving Israel the land that it was promised. It has shrunk. It's back to this point, 1999. Let me bring that out a little more forcefully. In Deuteronomy 3:26 to 28, God took Moses up to the top of Pisgah's mountain, or what is now known as Mount Nebo. Mount Nebo is in Jordan. And when Moses was told to get to the top of the mountain, he says, look north, look south, look west, and look east. Everything you could see will belong to my people. Well, if you circumscribe a circle that might approximate what Moses saw, these are the countries that would be encompassed by that observation. So that Israel is not now in all the land that God has promised her. Question, will Israel get this land on this side of the kingdom? Or will they get this land on the other side of the kingdom? Now, if you say, and if you judge, and if you decide they'll get the land on this side of the kingdom, then there must be another major war to make this happen before Gog invades. And there are brethren who feel that way. There's another big war coming up so that the land can expand. If you decide, if you judge that they won't get the land on this side of the kingdom, but on the other side, then the peace process that Barak is undergoing right now is significant. Because when peace occurs, this is the condition by which Gog will invade. Brethren, what we're saying is we're very close. If Barak makes this peace promise work, peace negotiation work, then we could see something significant happening. And as I look at Walter and his dates for 2001 and 2002, we may not need it. I wonder if Walter has a contingency plan. If he doesn't, I would suggest let's have a convention where we'll be. There's a parallel motivation to regather between Germany and the world. Germany in 1935, there were two motivators, the push and the pull. What pulled them was economic opportunity. That pulled them out of Germany, pulled them out of other countries to start some kind of economic opportunity, usually business. Anti-Semitism was the push. So it's a pull and it's a push. So in Germany, we find that economic opportunity and anti-Semitism. We think there's a parallel between what happened in Germany in 1935 and what's happening to the world at this point. Israel is a very, very significant economy. In fact, there is a debate now whether they're the number one electronics country in the world. Tremendous electronic devices and products. And so many of the people are going to Israel for economic opportunity, especially the Russian scientists and engineers. I'll come back to this in a little while. But what's happening now happened in Germany. Israel's time clock is a piecemeal pie. Peace is happening piecemeal. It was Sadat that got it started. Sadat did two things. He negotiated the peace and he recognized Israel. Then came Jordan. Jordan, the same two items. They negotiated the peace and they recognized Israel. Now we're into the PLO process. Barak is doing the same thing, Barak and Arafat, negotiating the peace and recognizing Israel. Barak says that in 15 months, that's a year and 3 months, a year and a quarter, peace will be established in the Middle East. He is so confident he's going to do this, he's got Clinton excited. Why is Clinton excited? Because Clinton would like to have in his library that he brought the Middle East peace process into the Middle East. kind of a last accomplishment as he departs from the presidency. 15 months. And so Barakas also says, we will also come to grips with Syria and Lebanon and have peace with Lebanon. Same two reasons, negotiate the peace and have them recognize Israel. Within 15 months. Now, 22 Arab nations have had a boycott against Israel since 1948. A lot of people don't know that. The Arab countries do not exchange products and business and commodities with Israel. Israel's boycotted. And so once Arafat gets his hands on the Temple Mount, as well as the Catholic churches and all the others, the Arab nations will pull out. They'll get rid of the boycott, and they'll establish that quite quickly. And thus, a period of peace will come to Israel, unless you feel that there's going to be a big war to get more land. If you feel that way, then it's adjusted a little bit. On the other hand, if you think this is it, when the period of peace starts in 15 months, this is the period that the prophecy in Ezekiel 38 and 39 comes into fruition. What is the meaning of peace? There will be peace in Israel. The scriptures assures us of this. It says it. But what does it mean? Well, it means Israel's right to exist is now recognized by the nations, and especially the neighbors. Second, I just got started, brother. It means terrorism will be eliminated. Peace means the cost of defense will be reduced, solving serious problems, water. Unwalled villages will develop. If the Golan Heights are given up, a defense barrier is removed. If the defense budget is reduced, another defense barrier is removed. If the United States leaves Israel alone, another defense barrier is removed. If Lebanon's security strip is removed, another defense barrier is removed. If these are done and Barak intends to do it, Israel will be alone, and the unwalled villages concept will be in place. Gog has been identified. The Gog of Ezekiel 38 and 39, which the prophecy fulfilled at this time. There's also a Gog in John's vision in Revelation 28. I don't believe these two Gogs are different. I think they're the same Gog. But it's not a nation and it's not a person. It's an ideology. There are four ideologies. The Social Democrats in Russia, which is Boris Yeltsin, which is also General Liebig. And then the ideology of communists revised and revitalized. This is Zinganov and Gorbachev and Primakov. Then there's the Islamic communists, which is the Primakov and Zhirinovsky. And finally, the fourth ideology, anti-Semitism. What we're suggesting to you, friends, is that the ideology at this point will come out as this point over here, even though it will be manifested by different countries or different groups. Gog's alliance. The scriptures say Gog, G-O-G, will have a confederation of nations. And we would suggest to you that Meshach and Tubal represents Russia. Gomer represents the Eastern Balkans. Persia represents Iran. Kush represents the Sudan and Ethiopia. Put represents Libya. And Togomar represents Turkey. Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. And radical fundamentalism are fanatics, and they are dangerous because they believe in holy wars, and they believe that God wants them to kill. Watch Turkey. We're suggesting Togomar is Turkey, and right now it's secular, but it will turn Islamic. When Turkey becomes Islamic, Gog's alliance is complete. There are two signs. Watch them. Two signs. When Turkey becomes Islamic and when Israel is at peace, then you know Gog's invasion is right around the corner. Two signs. Turkey becomes Islamic and Israel is at peace. Ezekiel 38 and 39 talks about a spoil and a prey. To spoil means to damage or destroy. To take a prey means to seize something. What does Israel have that Russia might want? Doesn't have oil, doesn't have cows, doesn't have land. But Israel has two valuable things that Russia wants. They have Jerusalem, which the Arabs want. So if they can get Jerusalem and turn it over to the Arabs and get a negotiation by controlling the world's oil, Russia will resume superpower. And if Russia has control of that oil coming out of the Arab countries, they got the world by the tail. The second reason is the Russian economy is in bad shape, and they want those Russian scientists and those engineers back. There's a third reason. The Russian communists are out to blame the Jews for the trouble that they're in, for the mess that they have. They're in an economic collapse. They're jealous of the United States because the United States just announced that they had $1 trillion in surplus. Do you remember that? That's your money. $1 trillion in surplus. Russia is just teetering on economic collapse. So the Russians are looking for a scapegoat. They are looking at the Jews have got us into this trouble. And truly, Karl Marx was the founder of communism. He was a Jew. He wrote the book Das Kapital. Lenin and Trotsky formed the first government. Trotsky was a Jew. But there was the Bolsheviks. There were 50 Bolshevik Jews that stormed the palace and overthrew the Tsar and the Tsarina. And this then set in motion the communistic movement in Russia. Russia is now blaming the Jews for their problem. The battle. The battle between God and Gog. The scriptures say that when Gog and the Confederates invade Israel, she will not be defeated and turned back. 84% of the invading army will be killed or destroyed. It will be a terrible slaughter. It takes 7 months to bury the dead people. How will God battle Gog? There will be a great earthquake. All parts of the Middle East and the land of Magog will be affected by this earthquake. Soldiers of various alliances will be confused and they will start killing each other in the alliance. There'll be torrents of rain and hailstones and burning sulfur. Weapons will fall out of the soldiers' hands. Probably bombs. It says fire on the mountains, which will probably be bombs being set down. Then fire will be sent to the land of Magog. We are not exactly sure exactly how the battle will occur, but we know one thing, that Russia will know that only a God, Jehovah God, has stopped them and will be thoroughly convinced that God is God. All nations will know that God intervened. They will know that God has fought for Israel against Israel's enemies as he has fought for them in the days of old. Remember in Ezekiel 38:16, all the nations will know that I am God. Gog will be turned back. 1/6 of its army will be destroyed. Gog will be buried in the valley of Hanan-Gog. Let me summarize and come to a conclusion. Here then are the events. Israel is regathered. This is happening. Israel becomes a nation. This has already happened. Israel receives trouble. We see that there's been a start, but the big one is still future. Jacob's trouble is still future. Israel land expands. This has happened, but not fully to God's promise. Israel sees Russia emerge. Israel enjoys peace. Gog is identified. Gog is motivated for Jerusalem. God is victor in Gog's battle. And let me conclude with a scripture in Ezekiel 39:27-29. I have gathered them out of the enemy's land. I will sanctify them in the sight of many nations. They shall know I am the Lord God that gathered them out of the land. I will not hide my face anymore. I will pour out my spirit upon the house of Israel. Amen. Heavenly Father, it's always a privilege and an honor to come before Thee, to acknowledge Thee in our lives, in our meditations, and now in our fellowship here in this convention. We are so grateful that Thou hast revealed unto us Thy plan of the ages. We're grateful that Thou hast revealed the prophecies, especially the one on Jacob's trouble. Correct us, Father, if we are wrong, and help us to see clearly Thy hand in these matters. May these insights strengthen us, strengthen our determination.